Renowned anti-apartheid activist, former UK cabinet minister and now a member of the House of Lords, Lord Peter Hayne, has just released a new book titled Liberation and Corruption, Why Freedom Movements Fail. And we have our honour to have Lord Hayne in the studio with us to discuss why so many of these movements all over the world, including the ANC, the party of Nelson Mandela, grapple with corruption and misrule once they've secured political power. Welcome to the studio, Lord Hayne.
Thank you, Linda, and good to talk to you.
Well, are liberation movements like the ANC just doomed to fail once they transition from resistance to governance?
Not automatically, but one of the things that haunted me, having supported the freedom struggle, having worked alongside the ANC and having been identified with it, especially knowing Nelson Mandela and other leaders of the struggle, was how it became in government a betrayal of its values. And then I began to look at other freedom movements, that, for example, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So we're talking about an entirely different continent, just to give one example, or the FLN in Algeria. What I looked for is why this seemed to happen almost without exception right across the world. And searching for the reasons for that became the focus of my inquiry. And it haunted me, and I say this in the book, and you'd have read it, because here we were, my mother and father sacrificed everything, the country in which they were born, young white parents of four children, of which I was the eldest, and they had to leave the country. They were jailed for supporting one of Nelson Mandela's stay-at-home campaigns in the early 1960s. Then my mother was banned in 1963, and my father was banned a year later. They were the first married couple to be banned, and that caused a problem for the government. And then they stopped my dad working, and we had to come into exile when I was 16 in 1966, unwillingly. So they gave up everything, but they never pretended that they sacrificed as much as Mandela did, or the other Rivonia trialists, or those who were killed or tortured or suffered long, long spells of imprisonment. They were at pains to say always that they were kind of foot soldiers. They made sacrifices, but they didn't pay the ultimate price like so many did. And then finding that their legacy, and the one I took up when I started to stop white South African rugby and cricket tours, as well as, you know, sports tours generally, because they were selected on race, not on you had to be white to represent your country under apartheid. I just felt when the ANC got into government increasingly, not under Mandela, but subsequently, particularly under Jacob Zuma, they were trashing that legacy. And I found the same was true of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and right across the world.
And that, what did you find? What is the reason, do you think?
Well, it's complicated, but you can summarize it in this way. First of all, colonial powers, Britain, for example, in South Africa, and the French in Algeria, or the Spanish in Nicaragua, Bolivia, Guatemala, Cuba, lots of others, were deeply corrupt regimes, not only in the way they stole the land and the assets off the indigenous people, in South Africa's case, black South African communities who were there long before whites arrived in the 17th century in the main. They stole those assets, including the land, but they then had poisonously corrupt regimes. And of course, you then get that colonial legacy morphing into apartheid in South Africa's case, which itself was deeply corrupt. So it seems that that just passes to the new government, even though it's elected on a platform and struggled in to overthrow the apartheid system in the ANC's case, a fascist regime in the case of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and you can go right across the world as I do. You find that actually in power, they become as corrupt as their predecessors. And I have lots of white critics of mine in South Africa saying, at least the apartheid system might have been brutal, but at least it was honest. No, it was deeply corrupt, deeply dishonest, especially the defense industry. The sanctions busting frontline businesses were deeply corrupt. And it seemed that that just carried on when the ANC got into power. There are a lot of other causes, not least the global picture in which these governments found themselves, the newly elected governments found themselves, and I'm happy to discuss that.
But if you argue that liberation movements inherit these flawed systems, many of these movements promised a radical renew and a clean slate. Does that excuse their failures?
Not at all. I don't in any way excuse corruption or, on the contrary, I blame those who have simply carried on as before or become deeply corrupt themselves and self-enriched as well at the expense of their followers who put them into power. And one of the things about getting into power, and I've been an elected member of parliament, I'm now an unelected member of the House of Lords, but I was an elected member of parliament for a quarter of a century in Britain and a government minister and a cabinet minister for 7 years in the governments mainly of Tony Blair, but also Gordon Brown. And trust is a really important thing, and it has to be earned, and very few politicians are ever trusted. But those of us who maybe have different relationships with voters from time to time because of the rough and tumble of politics, it's very different from putting your hands in the pockets of others and actually stealing their money, which is what happened under President Jacob Zuma's shameless 10 years of looting.
Well, the ANC frames corruption as a symptom of inequality and poverty. Is this an excuse to sanctify themselves?
No, it shouldn't be. Inequality is actually rising in South Africa and has been under an ANC government, as it is right across the world. Britain, the US, right across the world, we operate in a global neoliberal economic system, which accentuates inequality and indeed widens it so that the top 1% have done incredibly well, the top 0.1% stratospherically out of sight well, but the middle, the 90% in the middle, as opposed to the 10% who've done well, and then, as I say, the tinier proportions right at the top of that pyramid, the 90% have done really badly over the last 30 years or so. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen rising populism, the eclipse of centre parties across Europe in the advent of Donald Trump, Brexit in Britain. I think they're all part of the same phenomenon. The problems President Macron's having in France, the rise of the far right in France and the far right across Europe is also a product of that rising inequality. So the ANC is seeking to excuse themselves by saying they inequality and so on, and racism and the apartheid legacy is to blame. It's deeply culpable, all of those things, but you cannot excuse people just self-enriching themselves and their families, which has happened on such a brazen way.
Well, you set out how the West is complicit, not only consultancies like Bain that you pointed out, and you led an action against Bain because of their involvement with the Guptas in South Africa, but also governments are complicit. So, what role are they playing to fuel corruption?
A deeply complicit role, and this is an important part of the picture that I describe in the book and do so in some detail. You mentioned Bain and Company; they are the worst offender of all the global corporates that included KPMG, McKinsey, banks like HSBC, Baroda Bank, partly owned by the Indian government, the British originated Standard Chartered Bank, another global one. It was through their digital pipelines that all this looted money went. And in the case of Bain and Company, they didn't just work with the Gupta brothers. They actually took personal instructions in around 17 meetings, one-to-one meetings, in his private residence, not in his office where those meetings might have been minuted or recorded in some way, between President Jacob Zuma and Bain and Company, in which they were given instructions and then advised how to dismantle and disable the South African Revenue Service, SARS, once regarded as one of the best tax-collecting agencies in the world, and I think seeking to get back to that position now under President Ramaphosa, whatever other criticisms people have had, SARS is now starting to become more like itself. Instead of letting off the tobacco smugglers, all the bad guys that Zuma wanted to turn a blind eye to, and was advised on exactly how to do that by Bain & Company. So these global corporates are deeply complicit. And not only the corporates themselves, some of which I've mentioned, but also the governments. You're not going to deal with this problem. You know, money laundering is a massive multi-trillion dollar business of robbery and looting on a gigantic scale every year. And you're not going to deal with it unless the US government, the UK government, and also the Chinese government, the Indian government, the UAE government, because Dubai is a principal money laundering center. A lot of the Gupta's money went through there. Hong Kong is another one. That comes under China now. I know it's a special administrative region, but it comes under China. So what are they doing about it? What are the UAE doing about it? What is Britain doing about it? The UK has around $90 billion of looted money laundered through its systems every year. And the US similarly, and a lot of these capitals of the world proclaim their opposition to corruption and their detestation of dishonesty, but actually they're complicit themselves. So I say in the last chapter of the book that unless you get Delhi, the Indian government, Beijing for the Chinese government, Washington, D.C. for the U.S. government, and London for the U.K. government, as well as all the other European centers like Berlin and Madrid and Paris, cooperating to fight this financial crime, it'll continue.
Before we get to South Africa and the ANC, what's your response to consistent or persistent claims that corruption is uniquely African?
I reject that completely. Corruption is no more a black African phenomenon than the fact that some people are nicer than others. You get corruption amongst whites. We saw that under COVID in Britain, and I detail that. Prominent people looting through providing or pretending to provide personal protection equipment, PPE. You saw that in South Africa. You've seen that in just about every country around the world. And as I say, the looted money that comes from countries in Africa, including South Africa, goes to the global north. They don't keep us in the countries that have been looted. And they put it into what are seen as safer havens like London or the UK overseas territories, the British Virgin Islands, Gibraltar, the Cayman Islands. These are all UK, United Kingdom, overseas territories through which this money is laundered. Shell companies, front companies set up. The Guptas did lots of this, set up companies that, of which they were actually the beneficial owners, but were shielded from scrutiny because they weren't listed as such. They had other front people sort of taking responsible, alleged to be responsible for this kind of thing. So the global situation, the global economic structure, as well as the governments of the world and the global corporates, some the main ones I've mentioned, are deeply complicit. That doesn't excuse ANC politicians or others in the EFF and elsewhere who have looted and want to get back on that gravy train if they ever got power. That's one of the things I fear about the so-called MK party. I think they're interested in their own self-enrichment rather than empowering and solving the problems of the hundreds of millions, the tens of millions of poor people in South Africa. It isn't just a question of bad politicians. It takes two to tango. You've got to have businesses paying the bribes to the corrupt politicians who take those bribes. And it isn't easy if all your competitors are doing it, but that's no excuse.
In the beginning of the book, you quote Archbishop Desmond Tutu, He's remarked that the government stopped the gravy train long enough to get on it. And you also quote Nelson Mandela several times. In 1998, he warned about careerism within the ANC ranks. And again, where he said, we've learned now that even those people whom we fought the struggle against apartheid's corruption can themselves become corrupted. So what do you think Tutu and Mandela would now say about the ANC of today?
I think Nelson Mandela would be turning in his grave at what has happened to his legacy and the way it's been deeply prostituted and betrayed. I feel that. I'm sure he would feel that, having been privileged to become a friend, not a close one, but to know him relatively well, and having written a biography about him, the only short popular one. There are many, many long books about Nelson Mandela, and they're fantastic books, but mine's the only short one. So I did study and research his background and his story quite thoroughly, and I think he would be feel betrayed. Think, I spent 27 years of my life in prison. I didn't do it in order to see my comrades putting their hands in the taxpayers' pockets in the way that they've done so shamelessly and continue to do. I think South Africa today, as many have described it to me, is not, it doesn't have the brazen, shameless corruption that occurred under Zuma and his business cronies, the Gupta brothers. But I think the corruption's deeply entrenched still, and it takes place on a daily basis. The police officer stops you on a spurious traffic offense excuse. The bribe you have to pay to get a permit. I was even told by one of the students I was teaching at Pretoria University's Business School, Gibbs, how she'd gone to, and she was determined not to pay bribes to driving instructors in order to get her daughter the opportunity of a test, not to pass the test or fail the test, but simply to get a test. She was required to pay the driving instructors on about five occasions. She kept turning them down until she finally found one in the Gauteng region, which was actually, it was not corrupt. So this goes on a daily basis. The Home Affairs official who wants a bribe to give you a permit, perhaps for your Zimbabwean employee. You need a license or a permit to do something around your house. Somebody else always wants a cut. This is now deeply embedded in the very structure and the DNA of South African society. So everybody is involved. And, you know, I do say, it's easy for me to say because I'm talking from the UK, even though my childhood was in South Africa and I still feel closely connected with it. But it's easy for me to say from, you know, London, or somewhere else in the UK, don't pay the bribe, just say no. But I think it has to start with the individual citizen. If you don't start that, you can't begin to fight it.
Well, I can just say that I was asked for a bribe in foreign currency right in front of Oliver Tambo Airport by a traffic cop. That's how brazen they are.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, Linda. And, you know, I'm not going to pry as to what you did, but I was told by one of my other students how he was taking his sick mother to hospital and she was in mortal danger and he had to pay a police officer simply to make sure that she got to the hospital in time. Well, in those life and death situations, you can understand why people do what they do, but then, you know, don't moan about it. Don't complain about it, that the politicians are corrupt if you're doing your little bit to help them.
No, we didn't pay. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, do you think the ANC is in any way able to turn this around? Because if you look at their support, how it's declined, if you look at Afrobarometer, you know, and a study of them indicating that two-thirds of people say, no, you know, a military government won't be that bad. So is South Africa able to turn it around under the ANC?
I don't know the answer to that question. And it's in a way not for me to say, being a British subject now rather than a South African one. But I do think that some lessons can be drawn from the freedom struggle. It took a long time. You know, I remember my dad saying to me, it's going to take a very long time to defeat apartheid. And this was as a young boy in the early 60s in Pretoria. And, you know, he said it feels an omnipotent system. And of course, the police state was closing in on all dissent, including my parents at the time. And it felt, and I think in the current situation, people will feel that almost sort of absolutely dwarfed by the scale of the challenge. And what do they do about it to get good government? And I quote the Afrobarometer survey, especially of young people, which really worries me and disturbs me, that a majority of young people, including in South Africa, which went through such a struggle to get freedom and get rid of apartheid and to establish the best constitution in the world in terms of human rights, how that's applied is a different matter. But on, you know, in terms of the structures of the country, the ANC has done a magnificent job. But that was the ANC of Tambo and Mandela, rather than the ANC that which we have today. I don't know whether it can be rescued from itself. It doesn't look very likely at the moment, because there doesn't seem a determination to change. I mean, there are, even though I think President Cyril Ramaphosa has done his best, and for example, I mentioned the restoration of SARS. It's important that that has had been happening. Additionally, cleaning out the NPA, the National Prosecuting Authority, has been another achievement, but it's long, hard work to eradicate all the corrupt practices from those institutions. So these things take time. But there are, nevertheless, and it's to President Ramaphosa's credit that those movements are happening, and the restoration of the rule of law in some respects. But, the gangsterism, the mafia crime, and the grip on the whole of the society is there and isn't diminishing. And some of the people in the president's cabinet are corrupt themselves. There's no question about it. So, the ANC has got a lot to do to restore the confidence, not just of the young people, the majority of whom seem to want military rule and the strong person rather than what they perceive as a corrupt democracy, which I find dismaying, given the deep struggle that so many people took part in, Mandela and Tambo at the head of it, in order to secure democracy. And now it's perceived as failing a lot of people. So, I worry about that. And the other thing that I conclude from this, and I end the book in this way, is to say that perhaps we were naive in thinking that the job was done in 1994 when Mandela was elected president, apartheid was consigned to the dustbin, and the change began. Maybe, what we had to realize is that actually you've got to keep fighting for these values all the time. These battles are never won. They're continuous battles for social justice and equal opportunities and human rights and the rule of law and no corruption. These are values, these are struggles that have to be fought by successive new generations. They aren't at one at any one time, and perhaps that's what one of the lessons that I do draw and from this book that covers almost everywhere in the world that has experienced a transition from an independent struggle, like in India. It wasn't a liberation struggle in the way that the Sandinistas were in Nicaragua, or the ANC was in South Africa, or the FLN in Algeria. They were liberation struggles with a paramilitary dimension to them. India's independent struggle is also bears scrutiny, because you had Mahatma Gandhi's incredible people's movement to kick out centuries of British colonial rule, and then the Congress Party, which led that, and so nobly that freedom struggle, became increasingly corrupt in power itself. So that is not so much a liberation struggle as an independence struggle, and there are only one or two exceptions to that trend right across the world, sadly.
Finally, what's the fix? Because you mentioned a little bit that, we shouldn't bribe, we should start small. But what kind of global reform architecture could prevent liberation movements from sliding into misrule?
Well, you need to clean up the global financial system. When the bosses of HSBC and Standard Chartered came to see me in London after I exposed their nefarious role in the House of Lords under parliamentary privilege, when I speak in Parliament as I did as an MP and now as an appointed life peer, a member of the House of Lords, I do so under parliamentary privilege, which is a privilege. You've got to be careful of what you say is properly and honestly sourced so that you aren't just spreading lies. But these bosses of these banks came to see me and I said, look, you know where this money went. There's a digital trail to it. And they said, yes, but there's client confidentiality. One of the points I make is client confidentiality should apply to your bank account, Linda, I would hope to mine, and the honest citizens around the world who need client confidentiality in order to protect themselves from crime, apart from anything else. But here you have international criminals, billionaires, some of them, using the banks such as HSBC and Standard Chartered and Baroda Banks, digital pipelines, as I describe them, to move their looted money. And then these bank chiefs tell me they can't reveal where the money's gone because it's a question of client confidentiality. No, I'm sorry. Client confidentiality is not meant to protect international criminals like these guys are and were in South Africa's case. They should be tracked down and then the money should be returned to the looted billion should be returned in this case to South Africa's taxpayers. I mean, they bled the country dry. The country lost a fifth of its wealth, its gross domestic product. Its national treasury is virtually bankrupt by all this looting. You know, one of the most advanced countries in the global South, if not the most advanced country, South Africa, with incredibly good regulations, financial regulations, but nothing got in the way of the looting, and that's a very salutary conclusion to draw.
Lord Dieterheen, thank you so much. So interesting. And I think your book, the way it's been researched is just amazing. And I think a must read for anybody to see where it's gone wrong and where it can maybe change.
And it's published by Jonathan Ball in South Africa. So I hope that South Africans who are concerned about the future of the country might look at it, not to sell more books in my name, but actually to understand the predicament in which the country finds itself, and that it isn't just about the corrupt politicians, though they're big, that their culpability is clear. It's also about the global financial system. And one of the other things that I mention and describe is the need for a new international anti-corruption court, which there has been a demand in South Africa, led by eminent jurists like Judge Richard Goldstone, for example. And there are jurists right across the world who've drawn up a draft treaty. And I'm seeking to persuade my own UK government, Labour government, to support it. And they're sympathetic, but all the governments, including South Africa's, should support this. It won't solve the problem on its own, but it'll act as a powerful deterrent because there is no international court responsible for tracking down corrupt criminals and confronting them and, if possible, jailing them.
Lord Haynes, thank you so much.
Thank you.